Okay, hello, good afternoon. Can I have everybody's attention? One of our speakers is about to join us, but I'm going to begin anyway. On behalf of the Development Research Center and our Crisis States Program and the Development Studies Institute, I'd like to welcome you all here this afternoon to this debate about what to do about the gathering world financial crises. Our Crisis States Research Program and the Development Research Center are funded by the Department for International Development of the UK government. Our work is dedicated to understanding why some states or some regions or communities within states manage to survive and rebound from economic, social, and political crises, while others experience decline, collapse, and even violent conflict. We've organized the session this afternoon in the context of the global level research we're undertaking in this program. And we want to ask what role international finance may play in these processes of crisis and breakdown. In recent years, and indeed in recent months, we've seen a mounting incidence of financial crises to the point where they have unleashed riots in the streets and even the collapse of governments, as in Indonesia in 1998, or in Argentina in the last few weeks. Underlying the movement towards financial liberalization, there are assumptions about the superiority of the private sector to manage wealth and to regulate itself. One cannot help but think of the case of Enron right now, reading the newspapers today, or the role of Anderson Consultancy, which is supposed to have our public trust, as we begin to assess how positive or negative this movement is. In the late 1950s, Carl Polanyi, in his monumental book on the rise and what he thought would be the decline of modern capitalism, The Great Transformation, he argued that international finance in the late 19th century played a major role in securing what he called the long peace that finally collapsed with the onset of World War I. We need to ask today, what role international finance is playing? Should we see the push for financial liberalization as an integrating process that in the long run will allow the most productive and developmental use of accumulated wealth and contribute to long-term growth, stability, and prosperity? Or is it a process that seeks to maximize the profits of financial interests in the wealthiest corners of the world over the relatively short term while undermining prospects for development elsewhere by introducing volatility, instability, and the routes for capital flight from poor communities and states in the developing world? Our speakers today have all studied, written about, and debated these questions at great length. Robert Wade, to my immediate left, is professor of political economy and development at the Development Studies Institute here at the school. Most of you know him already. Gabriel Palma, who's joined us just now, is one of those exceptional people who has two PhDs, one in economics and one in politics. He's at the Faculty of Economics and Politics at Cambridge. And on the far end of the table is Lawrence Harris, who is professor and director of the Center for Financial and Management Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies up the road. So I'm going to ask each of them to speak in turn for a strict 20 minutes only. Then we'll open the floor to questions, and we'll have an open forum where the speakers will address some of your questions and again come back and debate each other's presentations. We plan to include an account of this activity on our website, as well as an account of your questions, and there we'll also put some references to the writings of our speakers tonight for those of you who want to study these questions at more length. So Robert, can I pass it over to you?
Thank you very much. Anybody who speaks about financial crises at LSE does so in the shadow of some distinguished LSE economists. Who have made seminal contributions to our understanding of financial crises. Charles Goodhart and a collaborator wrote an important paper on the comparison between the Asian financial crisis, 97, 98, that is at the end of the 20th century, and a series of financial crises in the areas of overseas European settlement at the end of the 19th century. And they show in this comparison that the East Asian crisis was not a singular event due to homegrown causes specific to East Asia, but an event whose causes were located partly in the international system into which emerging markets at the end of the, in the late 20th century have been integrated. And they show that the crises at the end of the 19th century were similarly due to a combination of internal and external causes, the external meaning the framework, the international system into which the emerging markets of that period, the late 19th century, were integrated. These crises at the end of the 19th century, the end of the 20th century, are different from the crises that occurred in, say, the 70s, in that there were private agents at both ends, the lending end and the borrowing end, in those of the late 19th century and the late 20th century, in contrast with those of the 1970s, where at the borrowing end there were public agencies, governments. Well, more exactly, they argue, Goodhart and his co-author argue, that the two sets of crises, those at the end of the 19th century, the end of the 20th century, had in common, first of all, poorly regulated banking systems at both ends. We may come back later to what exactly one means and how one can identify, quote, poorly regulated banking systems. Secondly, they had in common booms followed by busts in property and financial asset markets. Thirdly, they had in common open capital accounts, that is, no restrictions on the ability of private agents to bring capital across the borders in accordance with profit-seeking criteria. The government was not intervening to decide on what terms capital could be brought across and on what for what uses. Fourthly, they had fast export growth in the run-up to the crash. And then fifthly, what was common to both sets of crises was a preceding surge, a preceding sudden increase in international liquidity. So you had externally a big increase in international liquidity, which was slopping around, and these countries were opening the capital account in and having fast export growth, which then generated surges into those markets, blowing up bubbles, which then crashed. In other words, they took on very high amounts of foreign lending, and that foreign lending created financial vulnerability, which then, in response to some external shock, it might have been just a sudden withdrawal of foreign capital by some prominent lenders, which triggered a kind of a panic about the ability of these agents that were highly indebted in terms of foreign currency to repay their loans. That triggered a panic, so everybody pulled out, and that plunged the whole economy into crisis. With currency, sharp currency falls, banking collapses, and the like. So the bottom line of Goodhart and co-author's approach is that to understand why particular countries have financial crises and when they have them, one needs to look at both internal or homegrown causes and the external system into which that country and similar countries are integrated, and the dynamics of liquidity creation in that system. Well, so far, so obvious. Who could possibly disagree that financial crises are to be explained in terms of some mix of internal causes, like poorly regulated banking systems, and external causes, like the framework into which countries are integrated and the general level of world liquidity? Well, who could disagree? The World Bank and the IMF can disagree, not necessarily in principle, but in practice. That is, the fund and the bank's explanations for the Asian crisis, the Argentinian crisis, tend strongly to emphasize that the crises
are brought upon the crisis-affected countries by the people themselves, by the government of the crisis-affected countries. That is to say, the causes of the Asian crisis, according to Stanley Fisher and many other IMF officials, also World Bank officials, are to be found predominantly within Asia. They are homegrown causes. Crony capitalism, for example, is a homegrown cause. And the central thrust of the explanation of crisis for the bank and the fund has been to do with the internal causes, and they've been kind of wary about saying very much about the external causes, systemic causes of crisis. I think Krugman's metaphor is useful here. He made the point that if you take a stretch of highway where accidents are happening, for the first accident you may say, well, there was an oil slick on the road. For the second accident you may say, well, the driver was using a cell phone. For the third accident, maybe a hot air balloon distracted the driver or whatever. But if it turns out that there are many more accidents happening on this stretch of highway than in other parts of the highway, at some point even the highway engineer has to acknowledge that there may be something wrong with the highway, not with the drivers. And I think that that is a useful metaphor to bear in mind in order to understand what I take to be an empirical fact. The big empirical fact is that there has been a high and probably rising frequency of financial crises, meaning both currency and banking crises, especially in developing countries, but worldwide, since the early 1980s, relative to the period before that, after the Second World War. I take that as an empirical fact. The question is to explain that empirical fact. And the hypothesis that I want to propose is that that empirical fact can be explained in terms of the conjunction of at least two elements. One of them is the opening of the capital account, meaning the removal of restrictions, public restrictions, government restrictions, on the inflow and the outflow of financial capital by many countries, beginning in the US in the 70s, continuing in the UK in the 70s, sweeping through Europe in the 80s, in developing countries in the 90s. Increasingly, there's this wave of countries opening the capital account, lifting restrictions. That's one element. I'll come back to that in a second. The second element, just to put it on the table, is to do with the means of international payments that has been in place since the early 70s, of what seems to be a very boring technical subject, but I will explain how this is relevant. Just briefly on the open capital accounts, they were closed before in developing countries, before the 1980s. And it's important to bear in mind that European countries had more or less closed capital accounts through the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. And they did pretty well. This opening of the capital account, clearly pushed by US entities, with support, of course, from British entities, by US financial firms, British financial firms, and endorsed by many economists, saying that this opening of the capital account would make the world capital market more efficient. It is worth bearing in mind Keynes's conclusion about the Bretton Woods conference. Keynes came out of the Bretton Woods conference, and remember, the whole conference was about how to create a new international economic order which would reduce the frequency of crises that had been occurring after the First World War up to the Great Crash, reduce the probability that similar events would unfold, to create a world international order which would encourage the expansion of trade and reduce the instability to which countries were exposed. So he came out of the Bretton Woods conference saying that the biggest achievement was to make what had been heterodox orthodox. By heterodox, he meant the presumption before the Great Crash that all countries should have open capital accounts. He had argued against that and had persuaded people at Bretton Woods that open capital accounts were a bad thing, a source of instability. So the Bretton Woods Conference endorsed the right of governments to have closed capital accounts, which doesn't mean no flows. It just means that governments get to say which flows can come in, which flows can go out. China has a closed capital account. China has huge flows of capital. A closed capital account does not mean no financial flows across. So one cause of instability, open capital accounts. The second one, the one that very little attention has been given to in all the discussion about global financial architecture, most of which has concentrated on things like floating or fixed exchange rates, very little attention has been given to this other issue, namely the current system for making payments across currencies. And what my argument is this, that the current system of payments in international trade and other international transactions, which is based upon the dollar, helps to generate a high and probably rising frequency of financial crises in the world at large, and imposes large costs, especially upon developing countries, and in that subset of developing countries we now like to call emerging market economies. Why is this? Well, first of all, the US dollar is the main reserve currency. Over three quarters of world reserves are in the form of dollars. And the dollar is also the main currency for international transactions. This system, based upon the dollar as the main reserve currency, the main currency for international transactions, gives huge advantages to the US and imposes, I argue, great costs upon developing countries, including vulnerability to crisis. Why is this? Well, first of all, the system based upon the dollar generates large flows of wealth from countries that hold high levels of reserves in order to protect the value of their currencies to the US, and therefore mainly from developing countries to the US. Huge flows of wealth from developing countries, poor countries, to the US. Why? Because the main component of world foreign exchange reserves is dollar-denominated assets, such as the securities issued by the US Treasury and by other US public entities. They issue securities. Other countries buy these securities, put them in their foreign exchange reserves, but they buy them, and what they're doing is, in a sense, lending the US money at very cheap rates of interest. Very cheap rates of interest. And these flows of loans from developing countries to the US represent a transfer of wealth from developing countries, from poor countries to the US. The second reason is this, that this system causes other countries, especially developing countries, to intensify the restructuring of their economies, their societies, towards exports. Exports aimed especially at the US market, because the current payment system based upon the dollar forces each country except the United States to export in order to acquire the means of payment for imports. Means of payment for imports that their central bank cannot issue itself. They must pay for imports not in a currency that they can issue themselves, but in the form of dollars. Or, if they're not forced to export, they're forced to borrow in order to pay for imports, and that just means that they have to increase net exports in the future. So, the intensification of pressures on countries to exports in order to acquire the main means of paying for imports and for debt servicing induces this intensifying pressure to acquire these means, induces downward pressure, competitive pressure on developing countries, on their exchange rates. Each one tries to get the exchange rate down in order to increase its competitive position vis-a-vis other developing countries. And this, I think, is the main explanation for an empirical fact, which is the catastrophic deterioration in the terms of trade of developing countries with the North generally since the 80s, since around about 1980. The other side of this catastrophic deterioration of the terms of trade for developing countries to the North is that the North has gained very much in their trade relations with the South. So this is another way by which wealth is transferred from the South to the North, and specifically to the US. And the third effect of this payment system based on the dollar is that it generates a rising ratio of credit to real transactions. That is to say, it intensifies the process of what could be called the financialization of the global economy. It is an empirical fact that the ratio of credit to GDP, ratio of credit to trade, is going up, has been going up quite sharply. And the reason is because these increasing levels of foreign exchange reserves, which other countries are holding in order to protect their currency, this increasing level of their foreign exchange reserves is in the form of securities, US public securities, which then provide the basis for credit creation in the country that is holding the reserves. That's the mechanism, and I use that mechanism to explain what I described as an empirical fact of the rising ratios of credit worldwide, credit to GDP and credit to trade. Well, this system is very good for the United States, this system, that is, which is generating increasing financialization, this third effect of the payment system, because U.S. financial firms get to acquire most of the business, or a very large proportion of the business associated with increasing financialization, because U.S. financial firms are dominant worldwide. So what I'm saying is that this whole system of payments based upon the dollar generates big advantages for the U.S., but it disadvantages, it imposes costs upon developing countries, and it generates a higher frequency of crisis because this process of financialization of the world economy leads to more financial instability. And if I sound in saying this like some wild-eyed radical, of which I am told there are some in LSE, some still left, let me just read one sentence from the Bank for International Settlements annual report 2001. The Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, is, as you know, the club of the world's main central banks, a highly reputable body. In this annual report 2001, it says, quote, "The expansion of credit relative to real economy transactions is an essential ingredient in the buildup of imbalances in the financial system, the buildup of imbalances in the financial system, and in the excessive accumulation or misallocation of real capital." The language is very murky and inelegant, but the meaning is quite clear. So what policy conclusions, what can be done? The first thing that can be done, and I'm going to just mention quickly two, and they're both in line with what Keynes said coming out of the Bretton Woods conference. Both in line with what Keynes wanted at the Bretton Woods conference in order to create a stable post-war international economic order and avoid a repetition of the Great Depression. First of all, as I said before, countries should have the option of having closed capital accounts. And that does run quite strongly against the presumption in both the bank and the fund, and the U.S. Very much the U.S. Treasury. Second policy conclusion, this is much more radical, but it is in line with what Keynes said. Namely, we should end, or at least marginalize, we should abolish foreign exchange markets. And we should replace foreign exchange markets with a system that allows countries to engage in international trade and international investment in their own currencies. Keynes's proposal was for a clearinghouse, or for an international clearing agency, ICA, not to be confused with the Institute for Contemporary Arts, but the ICA, International Clearing Agency. And basically, I have 30 seconds to say this, but the agency would hold each country's reserves in the country's own currency as its liabilities and hold the country's securities in the country's own currency as its assets, and it would simply clear payments involved in international trade internally, just through kind of bookkeeping transactions internally. And you ask about the exchange rate. Well, the exchange rate would be adjusted every 2 weeks, every month, whatever, in terms of, in relation to changes in the reserves that the country held at this clearing agency. Well, is this, I'm just about to finish, is this pie in the sky? No, it is greater pie in the greater sky. This is a wild proposal. But these policy suggestions often take 20 years to kind of come to fruition. And if I'm right in thinking that we will, unless we do something like this, move to increasing probability of crisis, increasing costs of crisis, there will be a time when we're back in something like the Great Depression, out of which we will have a second Bretton Woods conference, and then you or your descendants can bring forward this proposal as I'm bringing it to you. And if you want to know more about this proposal, I have a paper in the Journal of Human Development, the Journal of Human Development, Volume 1, Number 1, 2000, where I spell out the idea of this clearing agent.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks very much. Gabriel, I'm sorry for the initial restrictions of time.
Thank you. The first thing, I'm basically going to talk about the Argentinian crisis. It's not easy to do so in 20 minutes, but I'll try to summarize what I believe to be the most important characteristics of the Argentinian crisis and the most important lessons that we can get out of this, and particularly for international finance. To start, I would like to say that I've been studying and actually witnessing financial crisis for a long time. The 82 one in Chile, the 94 Mexico, the 97 East Asia, the 99 Brazilian crisis. And believe me, I was there last week. The Argentinian crisis is a different ball game altogether. I mean, what we have there is something that is basically the disintegration of a whole society, not just an exchange rate problem or a foreign debt problem or a moratoria problem. And in that sense, Argentina, in a way, one have to look at this, the deeper lessons and the deeper causes of this crisis than just look at the more economic one. Briefly, I would suggest that there are three readings that can be done on this crisis. The first one is that what we can call the more economic one or the economicist one. And the best exponent of that, of course, are the articles you can read of Krugman and Sachs and the usual suspect in the usual newspapers, which are, I think rather good from this perspective. Basically, in order to, I mean, to summarize this, we have to very briefly go back to the 60s and 70s to the famous neoclassical counter-revolution. As you know, either because you are of a certain age like me, or as I hope you have read otherwise, in the 60s and 70s, there was this major counter-revolution in the neoclassical thinking, basically concentrating on three issues. One, on the inefficiency of ISI, of import substituting industrialization, particularly in Latin America. Second, these massive rent-seeking activities of the domestic capital, particularly through entry barriers. And finally, the inefficiency of state production. The solution was very clear, getting the prices right. What you need to do was this trade liberalization, financial liberalization, wholesale privatization, domestic deregulation, particularly of the labor market. And then, once you get the prices right, the resource allocation and all the rest will basically work, and you will find the possibility of some sort of long-term sustainable growth. Well, Argentina, as many people have said, and in the Financial Times, a major Wall Street banker was saying a couple of days ago, was the star pupil of this policy. This policy that led, of course, to the Washington Consensus and all the rest that is very well known. There is a famous quotation by the Argentinian foreign minister during the Menem period, somebody with a PhD at MIT in economics. Basically, when he was asked about what was Argentinian foreign policy in terms of financial markets, the relationship with the US and so on, he said that Argentina, as opposed to the rest of Latin America, did not just want platonic relationship with them, but they want carnal relationship with them. I think that he was quite honest in his statement, because in a way, Argentina engaged in this sort of macho neoliberalism game. There was nothing that they were not prepared to do. That they, for example, they criticized the whole of the rest of Latin America because they also engaged initially in the reform process in this fixed exchange rate. But one by one, they left it. Argentina was the only one who stuck to it to the end. And Cavallo often called the Chilean foreign finance minister of the time and other people the thesis of the neoliberal world, because they didn't have the guts to stick to this one-to-one exchange rate. As you know, a year ago, or 6 months ago, they had this zero fiscal deficit law. And there was nothing that they were not prepared to do. Now, what was the end result of this? The end result of this, you can see basically two things. On the one hand, like so many other Latin American economies, they got engaged in a process of where massive foreign inflow of capital led to substantial overvaluation of the exchange rate, leading to a massive credit expansion, consumption boom. For example, obviously it's not time to give you figures, but just one, import of consumer durables in Argentina in the first Menem presidency rose at the rate of 87% per year. And of course, this leads to a Ponzi balance of payment finance, because obviously you have to start borrowing to close the current account, and then you have to borrow in to pay the interest on the borrowing you had made to close the current account, plus to close the current account, and so on. And what ended up was in a $50 billion foreign debt, public foreign debt, which of course, eventually, no matter how much foreign international liquidity there is, and no matter how good pupil Argentina was, the game at some time was over. Something has to give, and this did. Then what Krugman and Sachs and so on says, and very rightly, and I wrote it about it also as well before, of course Argentina should have devalued 3, 4, 5 years ago. They should have de-dollarized the domestic assets and liabilities of the banking sector. They should have de-dollarize the prices of non-tradable, because one of the things that Cavallo did very early on to stick to the fixed exchange rate was to dollarize the non-tradable prices, telephone, electricity, gas, water, debts, and so on, so that if anybody were to devalue, non-tradable prices would have gone up as much as tradable prices, and therefore there would not be a real devaluation, therefore taking away any incentive for anybody else to devalue. But is this really the main lesson of the Argentinian crisis? After all, we have had many of those before. Plus minus 10%. I can tell you about many other experiences, certainly in Latin America, about this. In that sense, Argentina maybe was a little bit more stubborn, was a little bit more, had this extremely naive idea that the more fundamentalist you were, the better treatment you will forever get from international financial market, from the IMF, and for the rest. Of course, it got a very preferential treatment for a long time, but the game eventually was up. A second reading of this crisis is if we move from the 60s and 70s leading to the Washington Consensus and getting the prices right, we move to the 80s and the new institutionalist critique. Basically, the critique that says that what Latin America and the developing world needed was getting the institutions right. That the problem was that there were weak property rights, that contracts were not fulfilled, that there were these rent-seeking activities of the domestic capital and so on. Basically, the good governance issue, that unless there was, you could do trade and financial liberalization, privatization, and the rest, but unless you get institutions right, you will not get very far from that. And again, there is a lot of truth in that. I mean, there is a lot of, even if the criticism, even if the position is a bit abstract, when you bring it down to Argentina, of course, there is a lot to say about that. And this in the 90s was joined by the famous getting the social capital right. Add a bit of democracy, a bit of equity, a bit of decentralization, a bit of accountability, a bit of transparency, and you will have this pudding at the end that it will basically, the price is right with the right institution and the right social capital will basically mixed in a way that it will bring the whole thing into some sort of long-term sustainable growth. And the key characteristic of this position is that they always, every aspect of these theories, they seem to interact positively. If you reduce tariff, then you will reduce rent-seeking, then you will reduce corruption, then you get institutions right, then you get good governance. I mean, basically, it's this naivety that in the world, you only need a sort of first push, and everything then will somehow interact in some sort of dynamic, positive way, and they will end up in some sort of long-term sustainable growth with good governance and so on. Well, Argentina did this amazing trick of doing the whole of the Washington Consensus type of policy and ended up in a situation where the prices today and certainly before the devaluation were wrong, not only wrong, were even worse than they were before the reform. Where property rights not only are weak today, but they're certainly weaker than what they were before the reforms, where contracts not only are not fulfilled, but they're even less fulfilled than what they were before the reform, where corruption, of course, you have to add several digits to it and so on. In other words, what Argentina basically chose from this perspective is that basically changing economic policy and hoping that the rest will follow suit although the actual issues that these theories were pinpointing may have been real, the naivety was the sort of mechanic way in which some sort of change in policy were going to lead to some sort of dynamic transformation of the whole society. In that sense, Argentina is by far the country where the results from the point of view of the critique of neo-institutional and the social capital are clearly the worst, and where the structure of relative prices, and I mean, I was there last week, and I bought this wonderful Argentinian jacket, which was labeled at $800, and I got it for $200. I mean, relative prices, something was wrong in relative prices. I mean, when. I can recommend Argentina leather. if prices have to reflect value in Argentina, they don't. Okay, whatever they reflect is not value, and in that sense, what we had at the end of this process of reform is not only the prices wrong, but also, the whole institutions in a way that certainly they are worse than they were before. Now, the third reading is the one I would like to put forward, following writings of some friends of mine like Mushtaq and Jonathan and other people sitting here, is that what we have to go is a little bit beyond this analysis, in the sense that if you look at China, Thailand, if you look at many other developing countries, you find the same prices wrong, you find the same institutions wrong, you have the same social capital wrong, but they grow, and they grow in a sustainable way. Therefore, there is something else other than these two critiques, or three critiques that one can make to Argentina, in order to try to understand why the interaction of these things in the case of Argentina was so perverse, so extraordinarily and inefficient, and in the terms of long-term growth, I don't know how Argentina is going to get out of this. In that sense, what we have to ask is, who was capturing these resources? What use were they making of these resources? What was the discipline mechanism that were set in motion in Argentina in order to deal in some sort of efficient way with this problem? In that sense, what another naivety of the Washington Consensus that Argentina clearly shows is that they only think, bring the markets and the rest follows. Well, you brought the market in Argentina, and the rest didn't follow. I mean, you have to look at the nature of the state. Who is controlling it? What discipline mechanism are they basically developing? In that sense, my key proposition is that government in Argentina, particularly the Menem one, and the domestic capital in Argentina, simply use these reforms as another mechanism in order to have a new wave of corruption, rent-seeking, and the surplus extraction from the country. Of course, Argentina has today $150 billion debt of public debt abroad. But there's much more than $150 billion Argentinian capital abroad. I mean, the surplus extraction that took place in this period was completely extraordinary. I mean, one characteristic of the Argentinian domestic capital and of most of Latin American domestic capital is how risk-averse they are, in the sense that they steal and run as opposed to steal and invest domestically in a productive way. I'm not saying, yes, I know the penalties. No drinks afterwards. I mean, the key motto of the domestic capital in Argentina and the government was simply steal and run, as opposed to make at least any productive use of the resources that they were basically looting. In other words, you have a government not only that was completely unable to stop the looting, but basically join into this looting. And basically what you have is what you basically find today. In that sense, as I said, you have today a neoliberal economy where the prices are completely wrong, where the property rights are not respected, where contracts are not fulfilled, where corruption is extraordinarily large. I mean, in other words, where it has clearly been a massive step backward from from what happened.
Gabriel, just to clarify, you are saying that all this was true before the current crisis, what we call the current Argentinian crisis, all these distortions and so on and so on, occurred during the period when Argentina was taken as the poster child for these policies, yet they had these results, right?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, things had got much worse after the so-called devaluation, but before that, all what I'm saying is that was an economy where property rights were even weaker than before, where the prices were even wrong than before, mainly because of this exchange rate absurdity, where the contracts were not fulfilled, where the judiciary had been corrupted in a way that they had never been at that level in Argentina. So this before the actual crisis. Of course, after the crisis is a bit free for all at the moment. Now, my last point. What about what's left about the long-term development strategy for Argentina? Before this crisis, basically, if you look at this government and this domestic capital, and if you really think and talk to them and think about what was the actual factual long-term development strategy, it was very simple. Foreign direct investment. They could get on this looting while foreign direct investment was going to bring the resources, was going to bring the technology, was going to bring the management, was going to bring the skill, and was going to be committed to the long-term development of Argentina. Somehow, a sort of Mother Teresa type of foreign direct investment in which that while domestic capital and government was involved in this looting, somehow there will be this other agent, civilized, coming from this superior Anglo-Saxon type of world, in which they were going to basically commit themselves into this long-term development of Argentina. Now, what actually happened with foreign direct investment? Of course it came, and it came in a massive way. But ended up behaving in the same way as domestic capital. Why should they not? They got involved in the worst corruptions of the period. They got involved in the worst type of rent-seeking activities. They got involved in the worst type of contract problems. They got in the worst subsidies. I mean, I can give you hundreds of examples, but time is running out. But if any of you would like to know more, I will be very happy to give examples there. In other words, domestic capital came and began to behave in the same way as domestic capital and government. And that, of course, was part of the problem. And what about international financial markets? Well, in terms of getting the money out, the surplus extraction of domestic capital, using a phrase used yesterday by a US senator in the hearings of Aaron in the state, if domestic capital and the government rob a bank, international financial capital provided the getaway car, and the international the manager of the international banker was at the wheel. I mean, that was obviously was the mechanism in which this $150 billion went out of Argentina. And what about getting the money in? Of course, the international financial market joined this sort of initial mania in Argentina. I mean, Argentina was able to float $63 billion worth of bonds in the international financial market. That's more than one-fifth of all bonds of all emerging markets in the 90s. And the spread was high only in the last 6 months. If the average spread, including the last 6 months, was only 4 percentage points above the US Treasury bill. And what about the IMF and so on? Of course, I mean, you all know $36 billion worth of lending to Argentina so that they could continue the same game for a little bit longer. In that sense, international financial markets is completely oblivious about this. I mean, basically, of course, there is a massive problem of asymmetric information. I mean, 1% of assets of US pension funds is equal to about 75% of the capitalization of all stock exchange in Latin America. I mean, we're talking about two different animals, okay? Therefore, there is the Stiglitz type of asymmetric information problem, of course, they exist. But it's more than that, but of course, I don't have much time left. And my last point about the future. 1 minute or 2 minutes about the future.
Since Robert interrupted.
Yeah, since Robert interrupted me, I will I will multiply that for two. Okay. The first one is obvious. The whole of Latin America, not just Argentina, needs a second generation reform. A second generation reform, not of the sort that the Washington Consensus probably will tell you, but I mean, without institutions, Latin America will get nowhere. I mean, unless property rights are respected, contracts are fulfilled, rent-seeking activities are diminished. I mean, unless there is some discipline mechanism and some institutions there working, things will never get anywhere else than with one crisis after another and after another. But of course, this is necessary, it's not sufficient. And this is my main criticism to the neo-institutional economics. I mean, these are necessary conditions, but certainly not sufficient, and Latin America has proved that endlessly. And this leads to another question, which of course I don't have the answer in certainly in 1 minute. I mean, what should be the long-term strategy of a country like Argentina in this global open world? You can think of Mexico and Central America, the Maquila route, China, the cheap labor. You can think Chile, the natural resources. But what for a country like Argentina, or Brazil for that matter, which still had high wages, strong unions, a huge but backward industry? I mean, of course, the Pampa Húmeda, I mean, the weak Pampa is able to produce export worth of 10% of GDP. But to put very simplistically, unless Argentina doubles that, has no hope of ever getting anywhere in this world. Now, how do they double that? The Pampa Húmeda has done an amazing job of this 10%, but where will the rest come? Will it come from this huge but very backward industry? Are they going to go in the East Asian route? Very unlikely. Certainly with that domestic capital, I don't think they will get very far from that route. Are they going to go in the Chilean route of national resources with all the fallacy of composition and all the problems that Chile already is facing today? It's very unlikely. What is this development, long-term development strategy in this global world for a middle-income country on the upper range of the middle-income country? And the answer is not easy, believe me. And what for me is most surprising, in last week in Argentina when I was discussing with my friends and other people there, nobody's even thinking about that. When I made this question, they look at me as if we're coming from a different planet. I mean, this is an issue which in the whole of Latin America is practically nobody is actually even asking, let alone having the answer.
Now, if I could turn to our third speaker, Lawrence.
I think it's impossible for anybody to follow that, actually. But I shall follow it not by trying to talk about individual countries, but instead to talk about financial crises in general. The basic principle of what I'm going to say is that financial crises are nothing new. They're not new. They've been with us since the beginnings of capitalism. And moreover, they can't be abolished. Hence, when we talk about the gathering world crisis and what's to be done, the one thing we shouldn't be doing is trying to abolish financial crises. There are very many types of financial crisis. Argentina's financial crisis is completely different from that experienced in 1997 in East Asia, for example. But the most important financial crises, the ones that I think deserve greatest attention, are those which have their roots in real economy crises, have their roots in the fundamentals of the real economy, not just the financial markets. And some of those major crises, the crisis of 1929, the Great Crash in the 1930s, and similar crises, in fact, are often the precursor of growth and recovery. They seem absolute disasters at the time. Everything seems black, but they're often the precursors of growth and recovery. I mean, in our recent times, I mean, just to take particular examples, I mean, the Mexico crisis of 1995 was an absolute disaster, particularly since it was one of a series. But it has been the precursor to some dramatic shifts in Mexico's position. Similarly, Russia's crisis of 1998. Russia's economy is disastrous, has been disastrous since 1990, became absolutely wrecked in 1998 at the time of the crisis. But that crisis has been the precursor to some significant growth since then and some dramatic changes in the Russian economy. Similarly, the 1997 East Asian crisis. We all know that was followed by very rapid growth within 18 months in countries like Korea in particular. And even the remarkable events, those of you that can think that far back, of 1987, when the OECD stock markets, led by Wall Street, collapsed dramatically. It turned out to be a period that was followed by more than a decade of very substantial growth in the United States and in Western Europe too. So, what financial crises seem absolutely disastrous, absolutely awful, and of course they are for those who live through them, and many people suffer in the process as individuals within the economy. But they're not necessarily systemically the end of the world. I'd like to just, in order to come to grips with anything like that, though, we have to have some idea of what causes financial crises. And I want to say a few words about the East Asian crisis of 1997-98. I believe that crisis was essentially the type of crisis that was first described in the early part of the 20th century by Joseph Schumpeter. That's a Schumpeterian crisis. In other words, although on the surface it seemed as if the East Asian crisis was very much a crisis of the financial markets and irrational behavior of the financial markets that brought to their knees countries which were fundamentally strong in many ways, I believe that the underlying cause was were the fundamentals. It was a real economy crisis in the making. I hesitate to put forward this type of view, particularly with Robert here, since much of what I've learned about East Asia comes from Robert. And no doubt I'll learn some more from him before the evening's out. But the remarkable growth that had been experienced in the so-called tiger economies was a growth whose roots had built into them some limits. It seems clear in retrospect that that growth was not based upon rising total factor productivity, but to a large extent, I subscribe to the thesis that to a large extent it was due to increases in capital and labour without equivalent increases in productivity. And with that accumulation, which involved particularly high investment, eventually there was going to be diminishing marginal returns to capital. And indeed, that high investment in plant, machinery, etc., did show itself up as producing declining returns to capital in the years leading up to 1997. I'm not talking about simply sort of, you know, returns to financial capital. I'm talking about, in real term, returns of physical capital. So that translated into financial weaknesses. Though that accumulation had been based upon high debt, high leverage, and leverage ratios which were much, much higher in those East Asian economies than they were in, say, Latin America. And that translated into a much worse position for those companies, much worse financial position for those companies than, say, Latin American companies. They found that the ratio of profits to the interest that they were required to pay out was declining dramatically, particularly strongly in Thailand, but also in other countries in East Asia too. And you know, declining interest coverage was one of the things that certainly spooked the markets once the alarm bell started ringing with the currency collapse in Thailand. Of course, financial factors did have a part to play, just as they do in any Schumpeterian crisis, as has been well remarked by all students of financial crises. Real business cycles always have financial crisis at their peak when they're about to turn down. In the case of East Asia, those financial weaknesses in the markets led to financial crises, which then took on a life of their own. There was contagion between financial markets, which had further repercussions upon the real economies of those countries. So the financial crisis certainly takes on a life of its own in those circumstances, given the particular structure of financial markets at the time and the particular financial arrangements at the time, including the no longer sustainable fixed exchange rate system. Having said that, to me, subscribing to a Schumpeter type of thesis, I would see those crises as being the precursors to substantial further growth, because they lead to, they create, they facilitate a restructuring of the economy. And that restructuring takes place and has been taking place throughout those economies. I'd like to, just having sort of said something about that example, I'd like to turn to the more general question of, you know, financial crises in general. I was reflecting on the title of this evening's session, and it led me to wonder whether it really is reasonable for us to be talking about a gathering world financial crisis. I mean, it seems to me there are several ways we can look at this, and to me, one way we can look at it is in an extreme form. I mean, I know, you know, James and John are very good at developing a jazzy title to catch people's attention and to make sure that controversy rages, and all power to them for that. But it's very easy to interpret the title that they've given this as meaning that there is already or about to happen, you know, a breakdown of the world financial system. I'm sure they didn't mean it that way. Well, if that were the way it was interpreted, the answer is no. There is not in prospect breakdown of the world financial system, although we can count up the number of financial crises of different types. There is not a coming breakdown of the world financial system. Indeed, in my view, the crises have shown, actually, that the world financial system is extremely robust, very robust. The 1987 Wall Street and other stock market collapses was thought to be pushing everything to the edge. Now, when you look at the time series, you can hardly see that blip in those stock markets. It was just a minor blip. The financial system around those stock markets proved to be very robust. Similarly, you look at 1997, the East Asian crisis. The world financial system survived that and went on to make even more profits in an even more greedy way. 1998 was actually a year that saw much worse crises than the East Asian crisis of 1997. This 1998 saw the crisis of default, which was a huge default, much more significant than Argentina's, and also the collapse of a huge hedge fund, Long-Term Capital Management, which had wide-ranging links with all the powerful and big financial institutions. If the beginning of 1998 one had said, well, that's going to happen, what do you think will happen to the world financial system as a result? I personally would have bet that the world financial system would be closed down, would be brought to its knees. In fact, it came through 1998 relatively unscathed. And one can take other examples too. So I don't think that gathering world financial crisis means that there'll be a breakdown of the world financial system. Does it mean that there will be more individual countries going through financial turmoil and associated real turmoil like Argentina? I think, yes, quite possibly. But that's not a big deal. It's a very big deal for the population of Argentina and some outside of Argentina. But it's something which all countries have gone throughout their periods of industrialization and integration into new types of world systems. And we have been witnessing sort of dramatic sort of processes of integration in different ways into world systems. So, in the long historical sense, those integration crises are not crises that represent sort of a breakdown of the world system. I think then when we're talking about the world financial crisis, what we have to recognize is that we do have a new world financial system that has grown up in the past 30 years, but more acutely in the past 15 years, enormously expanded and more complex currency markets and currency trading, which, as has been said, has relatively little, has almost no direct connection with trading. Enormous expansion of investment funds, enormous expansion of derivatives markets, and enormous expansion of hedge funds. I'd just like to make some observations about that new world financial system that has come into existence and that seems to be so mysteriously connected with all these problems that we're facing. The first observation is that I believe that a lot of the factors driving those financial markets are actually demographics. The important thing affecting, driving those world financial markets and the growth of, for example, investment funds, but also currency markets, is simply demographics. It's changes in savings rates, and most importantly, differences in savings rates and investment rates between countries which are very much affected by the question of whether they have an aging population or a population that's growing younger. Those demographics, demographics of that type, are the things which, to me, are the most fundamental factors in driving whether countries have balance of payments, current accounts, surpluses, deficits, or whether those countries have net savings which they have to export or net dis-savings that they have to import through currency markets and through investment funds. The second thing that the second observation I'd make is simply the role of derivatives markets. The growth of derivatives markets has been absolutely extraordinary. Derivatives have been with us for many centuries, but the types of financial derivatives that we have now are an invention of the late 20th century. And it is they, rather than simple currency markets or simple equity markets, that are a dominant force within financial trading. But are they bad things? Well, on the one hand, they're extremely good things. They increase liquidity in financial markets, and increasing liquidity means you can actually trade. You can actually carry out financial trades. And that's very important for real manufacturing, operating, service sector, manufacturing sector, agricultural sector, mining sector companies. But of course, it's also true that derivatives do enable greater degree of speculation and risk-taking. The third observation I have is that there are unregulated financial institutions. We can see that, for example, in the case of Enron. Enron was such a new type of institution that it wasn't at all clear which body should regulate it. And as you know, nobody regulated it. But the particular type of institution that we should take note of is hedge funds. Hedge funds are vast funds, funds that can amass huge amounts of funds to use in various ways. The objective of all hedge funds is to invest in a manner which where the hedge fund itself is not investing its own capital, but is investing other people's capital. It's borrowing. It's extremely highly leveraged, more highly leveraged than any bank could ever be. It attracts that funding by promising both high returns and high risk. And that's what they do. They aim for high returns and high risk. They do it in various ways. Different hedge funds have different ways of doing it. The most notorious being those like Soros's 1992 hedge fund, which took a bet against a currency. In that case, sterling. Are they bad things? Well, they're good things and bad things. It is the case that in the East Asian crisis, some hedge funds did show their worst side. In the East Asian crisis, it's now quite well established that they were able to dominate some of the crucial currency markets, take a one-way bet. In only one case was that one-way bet by the hedge funds defeated, and that was in Hong Kong, where they had a very clever structure of one-way bets, but the Hong Kong authorities had such a large amount of resources they were able to defeat the hedge funds. In other cases, they weren't able to defeat them. But it's also the case that hedge funds have a positive side to them, that they do increase market liquidity, and without them, markets would be a lot less able to operate. The fourth observation is that markets are extremely irrational, driven by, and that effectively means greed, driven by ignorance. We see that with irrational exuberance. We see that in the sense that exchange rates become completely wrongly aligned. I mean, we've had long periods where, say, the yen and dollar exchange rates have been in a ludicrous position. Compared to the fundamentals of those economies, simply because markets are irrational. They don't get the prices right. There's no question about that. My fifth observation is that financial crises are often seen as an example of the problems of globalization and an irresistible force, because globalization is, quote, an irresistible force. I don't believe that. I don't believe that we have a globalized economy or that globalization is an irresistible force. I believe we have a very strongly fractured kind of world economy where there are all sorts of regional and national orientations rather than international. Just looking at that in terms of capital markets are not integrated across the world. Even if you take a country that's as highly sophisticated as the United States in financial terms, there is almost no foreign investment compared to what would be an optimal level of foreign investment as calculated by portfolio theory. And that home country bias runs through every study that we see in every capital market. What should be done? Or the title of my favorite book from my student days, What Is to Be Done? I think I have an advantage over Lenin, which is that I don't have to give an answer because James has just told me that my time is up. I'd be happy to say something about that if questions come up about that in question time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Good thing I wasn't chairing Lenin's talk, or maybe I should have been. I would like to immediately open the discussion to the floor. We do have two microphones around. If you could just raise your hand, I will point, and somebody will come to you with a microphone. There is one upstairs and one downstairs. So how about the gentleman on my right here? I'll take a few questions to start and then turn it back to the panel.
My name is Jim Kennedy. The first speaker cited one aspect of the current financial the crisis situation that is attributable to the status of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. What sort of impact will the emergence of the euro have upon this aspect?
Great. We have here.
Hi. I had a doing too well here. Hold it just get both microphones at the same time. I had a quick comment for Robert and a quick question or comment about Argentina for the second two speakers. One of the comment, can I just do without the mic?
cut out people upstairs? Could we have, there are people upstairs, and so we'll keep them in the...
The gentleman on the far right argued the pros and cons of derivatives and hedge funds. And in both cases, the good side of those two areas were the way they increased liquidity in capital markets. Yet his fourth point was that capital markets are inherently irrational. How exactly does that make those good agents?
Yeah, to the third speaker. You said that financial crises are impossible to abolish. Given that they're impossible to abolish and the fact that they do have only been occurring since the configuration of the actual or the present financial system, they've only been occurring in newly industrialized countries or poor countries. Would your forecast be, because countries do grow after a financial crisis, but this growth is actually compared against the decrease it had before. So they never achieved the growth they had former to reforms or former, at least that's the experience, I think, on Latin America. And from Robert Waite's data, inequality has been rising and purchase power has been diminishing. So would your forecast be that since this crisis only occur in newly industrialized countries, these are never going to under the current conditions, these are never going to graduate to be advanced economies?
This round, and then I'll come back to some more.
I just wanted very quickly to ask Lawrence.
I will come back for some more questions, but let's let each speaker begin to have a shot at responding. No more than, say, 4 minutes. Can I go in reverse order and ask Lawrence?
It's always the same at LSE. You just get terrific questions coming up. I mean, it's just wonderful. Let me just say a word about the first question that came from the balcony. The statement that derivatives and hedge funds increase liquidity in capital markets and currency markets, but those markets are themselves irrational. Putting those two statements together must mean that hedge funds and derivatives are disastrous. I don't believe that is the conclusion that would follow. And the reason for that is simply that if you have markets that are not liquid, if you have markets where trading cannot occur easily, then the irrationality in financial markets becomes exaggerated. That you're always in a position where investors, if you want to call them that, are unable to sell, and therefore price movements get exaggerated. For that reason, I'm quite comfortable with what I said, but in order to deal with it, I'd like to sit down with you for half an hour, or until the next financial crisis, really. And The point that came up from the floor in the stalls here was the very good point that when we look at the financial when we look at the experience of financial crises in developing countries in recent years, even if growth does occur after those financial crises, it's starting off from a lower point, and people suffer. And the country is in a weaker position than before in that sense. Yes, that's true. It starts off from a lower point. in some cases, it can lead to faster rates of growth or very long sustained rates of growth that take you well above where you started from. We're not in a position to say whether that's occurred as a result of the 97 crises or Mexico's 95 crisis or Russia's 98 crisis yet and so on. But if one looks back into history, we can certainly see that happening. A very good example is Britain's financial crises of 1992 and financial crises of the mid-1970s. John's question is very pertinent and very much to the point. You know, in what sense could Argentina's financial crisis be called a Schumpeterian crisis? And I certainly wouldn't claim that it could. I have absolutely no doubt about that. I said right at the beginning, there are many, many types of crises, but the ones on which I'm focusing attention are those which are Schumpeterian crises. I must say, though, with the Argentinian crisis, I don't believe that orthodox policies were followed, I have to say. I mean, it wasn't a case of having the prices, getting the prices right, because there was one crucial price that wasn't allowed to adjust, which was the nominal exchange rate. And secondly, it wasn't an orthodox policy because some large fiscal deficits were allowed to accumulate in a complex manner. So, I see that in much more sort of simple macroeconomic terms, but I certainly bow to Gabriel's judgment on all the corruption that went on. My only comment on what Gabriel said about the corruption was just a terrific admiration for Gabriel's style. I mean, when Gabriel said, you know, this was a steal and run economy, he said it with the most incredible surprise, you know, like he wasn't really expecting that to have happened. I know Gabriel has a much more worldly view than that. Thanks very much.
From a worldly view, the key issue I'm saying is not that, I mean, to be surprised or not surprised, believe me, I'm a Latin American. Although I have lived 30 years in this country, I'm certainly heart and mind there, and certainly research there, and there are very few things that surprise me these days. The key point I was making is this naivety of the Washington consensus, in the sense that if you get the prices right, then institutions will get right, then social capital will get right. If you reduce tariff, then you will stop rent-seeking, as if rent-seeking will not simply be readjusted to some other aspect of the economy and other forms. In other words, this issue that somehow, if you get some quote-unquote economic policy right, the rest will follow suit, which is the key issue, the question to consensus. And that is, of course, one of the main lessons of Argentina, which is certainly not the case. There are several issues, but I want to start with one that deals with one question, but also with what Lauren said, this issue about how wonderful this increase in international liquidity is. In that sense, I am an unreconstructed Kindlebergian. I believe, like Kindleberger wrote wonderfully in that book, Mania, Panics and Crashes, which I recommend everybody to read, is that there is one thing common, and only one thing common, to every financial crisis from the Napoleonic Wars until today, that they had been preceded by a massive increase in international liquidity. Lauren said, oh, wonderful, because it helps trade. The amount of liquidity needed for international trade today is less than 10% of the international liquidity that goes on, meaning there are several estimates that are going from 1% to 6%, roughly, certainly single digit. The other 90% is certainly neither related to trade nor needed for trade. This increase in international liquidity is basically what fuels this mania process, these bubbles which end up in the case, as in the case of Argentina, in the way that they did. And as long as this international liquidity is there, and as long as it continues to behave in the way that it does, we certainly will have financial crises like we have had in the last 5 years, one after another. In that sense, that the lesson we have to learn from that is that countries do need, particularly developing countries, do need exchange controls, like Chile did for a while in the 90s, that Malaysia did in 98. If international financial markets, particularly the shorter movement, behave in the way that they do, countries have to defend themselves through exchange controls. They do have to have very strong and clear domestic regulation for the domestic financial system and so on. In other words, it's no good to say financial crises are here to stay, because of course they're here to stay, but what are we going to do about it? And one lesson that we have learned from Latin America, and certainly from the Chilean experience, and in Asia from the Malaysian experience, that the exchange control do work, and work rather efficiently, and are very able to diminish and reduce the amount of short-term debt that goes into this country. In other words, we shouldn't just sit and wait for the next. I know we are academics, but I think that we should try a bit harder in that sense. Another question about the Washington consensus that destroyed economies, that they didn't even spend. Two things. One, capital flight is a form of spending, by the way. It's just that the multiplier is zero. the multiplier of that spending is zero. But believe me, the $150 billion Argentinian capital abroad is a form of spending. Obviously, by what I have said, and if you, by any chance or mistake, you have read anything I have written, you will know that I am not a Washington consensus person. But you might have gathered that. But Washington consensus don't destroy countries. Governments and domestic capital do. I mean, we have to keep things where they belong. I mean, trade liberalization doesn't destroy countries. I mean, trade liberalizations in Argentina do destroy countries. In that sense, I mean, even policies which I would not favor, like some of the Washington consensus, I don't believe that they by themselves destroy countries. It's the way that domestic capital and governments behave under those circumstances. And my main hypothesis, as I said before, is that Argentina government and domestic capital use economic reform and liberalization as just another wave of corruption, rent-seeking, and so on. About Argentina today, this is very important. I mean, what is happening at the moment, which I didn't have time to go very much in what I before, very briefly. The key characteristic of Argentina, as opposed to Brazil and Mexico, or even Chile in 82, and East Asia 82, I mean, the closest will be what happened in Indonesia, but you have to multiply by a factor of several numbers. It's basically that you have the most extraordinary institutional crisis and political crisis, as well as the economic crisis. Today in Argentina, basically, you have no government. There have been five presidents in the last month, and I'm sure if you go to Ladbroke, you can get good odds in the short-lived for how long this current president will live. There are no political parties. No political parties. I mean, the Frepaso and the radicals are completely disintegrated, and the Peronists are divided in several factions. Even the CGT, the trade union, is divided in three factions. And if you know a bit of about Argentinian politics, you know that the Peronists solved their internal dispute, sort of Chicago 1930s. Therefore, what's happening next in the Peronist party is almost frightening. There is no property rights, there are no contracts, there are no law and order. It's a country which has fallen in complete and total anarchy. And there is no economic policy. I mean, every day, whoever is in government comes with a different economic policy, and everybody is glued to these television sets in the news in the evening to see what they can do the day after in terms of whether they can withdraw their deposit, they cannot withdraw their deposit, at what exchange rate are their deposits going to shift, and so on. In other words, this is the most extraordinary and deep crisis I have seen in Latin America, I think, in my lifetime. And I'm not very optimistic about what is coming next. because it's just not the issue that Argentina has been saddled with this $150 foreign debt with a
billion,
$150 billion, yes. I know. Just about what the Argentinian football team is worth at the moment. But for example, I mean, just to give you a couple of figures, I mean, the capitalization of domestic banks is about $16 billion. The known losses of the domestic financial system is $55 billion. I mean, who is going to put that $40 billion in the middle? I mean, a country that has no financial system, that has no government, that has no political party, no the judiciary is completely, not only completely corrupt, but is completely inefficient, even in their corrupt ways. And I never thought I would live to see a Latin American army which is unable to take power because of its inefficiency, its divisions. I mean, this is what the most extraordinary situation in Argentina, that the country is in its knees and it's completely disintegrating and the army is unable to do anything about that. Fortunately, in a way, but I never thought I would live to see that. And I think that basically is the most important sign of the disintegration of the Argentinian society.
Could I just interrupt, James, just to correct a misstatement there? I did not say that it's a good thing for there to be an expansion of liquidity and that that enables trade to take place. I was referring to liquidity in the sense of finance analysis, which means simply that markets become more liquid in the sense that people who own shares, company bonds, currencies, etc., can find a buyer when they want to sell, and people who want to buy can find a seller who wants to sell, and that they can do so at relatively low cost. The different meaning of liquidity and liquidity expansion that Gabrielle's referring to is, of course, describes a very dangerous situation and one that's to be abhorred.
Okay, Robert gave up his time to Gabrielle, you see, that's why I let Gabrielle go on. And I'll just take a couple of more questions and then come back to Robert first, then Gabrielle and Lawrence. Terry. Do we have that mic? Because we're actually trying.
Sorry, I was just going to take issue with the point that it was somehow to do with the portfolio decisions of central banks that was explaining what was going on in the world economy and that the dollar denomination of trade had something to do with that. I think both of these things are completely red herrings. That the reason the US is able to run a very large current account deficit and has been for some time is because the rest of the world, including Argentinian thieves and aging Japanese households, are very happy to hold assets in dollar form. And it's not what the central banks want to do, how they want to hold their foreign exchange, but it's rather how the rest of the world, including for very good reasons, people who are stealing from developing country economies, how they want to hold their assets. And the reason for that simply is American financial assets have appreciated in value very rapidly, whereas the financial assets of other countries have been falling relative to those of the US. So I don't think the answer is to somehow force central banks or encourage central banks to change the way they hold their reserves. I don't think that's got anything to do with it. In terms of the magnitudes, it's true that some central banks in developing countries have accumulated dollar assets, but that's simply because they've had large capital inflows, and that's the answer, or that's the problem. And I think we've had some suggestions from other speakers about how that could be dealt with. The other thing I'm puzzled about is the prescription, which involves a revival of the clearing union, and the picture that we were given of somehow the clearing union deciding on a fortnightly basis to balance or force balance on current account across the world seemed to me very unrealistic. But the other implication of it would be that if you were going to have that bit of the Keynes plan for the Bretton Woods institutions, you'd also have to have a true international central bank, which was the other bit that he wanted. And if you had a true international central bank, not the IMF, but a bank that could actually create deposits, then you would need that institution to have a lot. We now know from the whole problem about asymmetric information and lending, we'd now have to have an institution which had a lot more information about the counterparts to whom it was lending. And that would mean you would have to have enormous faith in the capacity of that institution to run itself. In other words, you would have to be very optimistic about the capacities of the international institutions. So if you're a little bit critical of those institutions for other reasons, then it seems to me inconsistent to call for a revival of the Keynes plan. The Keynes plan was based on a great deal of optimism about the potential for central banks domestically and an international central bank to operate in a world economy of the type we have.
Thank you. I have somebody else disappeared down here. There's two quick questions from up on top, and then I'll turn it over to Robert, and then very briefly, Gabrielle and Lawrence. Hi. Please be brief.
Yeah, okay. It's a comment with a question at the end, and it's in relationship to Argentinian crisis and how do we understand this and how do we interpret this. And it was just that I'd like to say that I didn't think that it's just an economic crisis or a question of the institutionalization of the market, but also it's a political question. And what do I mean by that? And what I mean by that is that the neoliberalization of Argentinian society under Menem was a political process which was based on the disarticulation and the fragmentation of the majority of civil society and their defeat as political actors. And this occurred, this political process, by a process of disintegration and undermining of old political relationships, which did allow some form of interest articulation and representation without them being replaced by anything new, which is quite a common phenomenon throughout the region. So maybe we need to repose the question and also the solutions that we talk about when we discuss Argentina and the region in general. And instead of focusing on the problem of the reconstitution of the institutions of the market, we should look at the problem of the reconstitution of political society.
Thank you.
And the social forces that it represents.
Yes, my question is about the whole subject of the financial crisis that was mentioned by all the speakers here. But really, it's about how it affects the south side of the world in terms of the developing countries. And in my opinion, that does the panel really believe that this it really indicates the end of capitalism as we know it now, despite the optimism mentioned by the third speaker in terms of it reforming itself and more or less plastering the wounds that it has created in the 20th century and the crisis that are moving laterally across the third world from one country to the other? Does that not indicate an imbalance in the system as a whole in terms of its structure, which I believe is beyond reform, and the majority of the world probably needs to have something to replace it in its present form?
Thank you. Robert.
Is that working? Yes. Just one quick comment, really, on the last gentleman's comment. He said that the idea of an international clearing agency stroke world central bank is unrealistic, in particular because there are enormous problems of information flows and governance associated with that idea, to which my answer is yes, of course, but it is the function of a university as distinct from the City of London or Wall Street to play with, so to speak, to promote ideas that do seem to be very unrealistic. That's the function. But let me just finish by pointing to a real life case of spectacularly inaccurate information or prognosis about the future. This is from a World Bank publication, April 1997. That is to say, 3 months before the Asian crisis, followed by the Brazilian crisis, in which the World Bank, under Joe Stiglitz, newly arrived economist Joe Stiglitz, speaking here in a few days, differentiated itself from the fund. The fund was saying all countries should open their capital account, open to the world financial markets, more or less immediately. And the bank was saying, no, 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 you have to think of an evolutionary sequence. Some countries have more robust domestic financial systems than others, can withstand opening better than others. So let there be a sequence of countries opening up with the strongest ones in the front. The World Bank went on to make a bad tactical mistake because it identified in April 97 which countries were at the head of the queue, had the most robust financial systems, and I'll read you the list. Korea, Malaysia, Thailand, with Indonesia and the Philippines not far behind, and two markets in Latin America, Chile and Mexico, with Brazil also ranking well. So this was the bank's attempt to identify which countries had sound banking systems, robustly enough regulated that they could integrate without danger to the domestic economy. That was the result. So you have to put alongside, yes, the real hazards, obviously major problems. I would be the last person, except on this platform, to really seriously entertain the idea of a world central bank for the reasons that you indicated. But there are certainly there are these major problems, but there are real big problems with what Larry Summers, what Candace Su, what everybody was saying during the in the wake of the financial crisis. They were saying the lesson to be learned is that countries must integrate into world capital markets when they have sound financial systems in place. My point is we don't actually know how to identify a sound financial system very well in advance. Therefore, countries have to err on the side of caution in opening the capital account. That's the main policy conclusion I come to.
Thank you, Robert. We have time for just a sentence or two from our other two speakers to wrap things up. Lawrence first, maybe.
The final question was, can capitalism survive in its present form? And the answer is no. Capitalism is always changing, and it's currently going through periods of dramatic change. I can't give a prognosis as to what it will look like. I tried giving such prognoses 30 years ago and was completely wrong, so I'll stop.
First, very briefly, let's go back to this liquidity issue because I think it's absolutely crucial to understand. You, Lawrence, were talking about this whole issue of derivatives and so on. I mean, what international financial markets are characterized today is by two things. One is by this extraordinary increase in liquidity. Just to give you one data, a financial asset of non-banking financial institution in OECD market, it doubled in the 1990s. That was about increasing by roughly by 40 percentage point of GDP. And the second characteristic is that it's almost completely and totally unregulated. And as long as we have this LTCM, remember the long-term management company, that institution that can have capitalization of $4 billion and positions of $400 billion, we are going to be in one financial crisis after another financial crisis after another financial crisis. Liquidity is at the basis of the problems we're seeing today the world over, certainly in the developing world. And as long as this liquidity continues to grow like that and is totally unregulated by that, and developing countries don't develop policies like exchange control to defend themselves against that, we're going to go from one to another financial crisis. About Argentina, the question about what is one of the characteristics of the neoliberal revolution in Latin America, in a way, is not different from what happened in Russia. It's the same usual suspect from before that led and did the looting in the revolution. In other words, it's not that there was a different group, it's not that there was a different force, a different class, a different social formation that led to this revolution. It's basically the same domestic capital and the same political parties, in the case of Argentina, the same Peronist party, which basically led this neoliberal revolution. And of course, that is very important to understand what happened. And the key characteristic of what happened in Latin America, and happened all over the world, but in Latin America, things tend to happen a little bit more dramatic than other places, is that there was an extraordinary ideological vacuum that was filled by this neoliberal revolution. And my proposition here will be that when an ideology is unchallenged, is when it really becomes fundamentalist. and that's what happened with the neoliberal ideology in Latin America. I mean, Cavallo is Osama bin Laden as a minister of finance. I mean, I am not mixing my words. I mean, what you have in Latin America is people who were prepared to go all the way to raid pension funds, to rob all the savings of the whole population as long as they could continue paying interest on their foreign debt. I mean, we have, they were prepared to completely destroy a country before devaluing. For as the example I gave you, Cavallo, when he was Minister of Finance, the first round in the Menem period, without any necessity, without anybody asking him, he indexed to the dollar the prices of non-tradable, so that under no circumstances Argentina could devalue, because if the price of non-tradables would go up as much as tradables after the devaluation, of course the real exchange rate will not change and the devaluation will be useless. And half of the problem that exists today is the problem of how you de-dollarize the prices of non-tradables and of course the asset and liabilities of domestic bank and so on. Therefore, in that sense, I don't think it's the Washington Consensus that destroyed Latin America. It's two things. It's domestic capital by government, plus the fact that that ideology went on unchallenged for too long and became so extraordinarily fundamentalist that it didn't work even in its own terms.
Thank you very much. Can I thank you all, and anybody who wants to continue to debate among yourselves this, you could find a place to do so on the Crisis States website. I'm sorry for questions that you may have had that weren't answered. Let's thank all our speakers for the fabulous contribution.